Beyond this green field, men assault the trees, the earth, building a prison.
This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, poems from the inside. For the past few weeks, prisoners in many correctional institutions around the country have been on strike. They're protesting against slave labor, basically working for pennies on the dollar. Some are refusing to go to work, others are not shopping in prison commissaries, a few are reportedly on hunger strike. Most of us don't think much about what life is like for the millions of men and women in American prisons. Occasionally, though, there's a prison strike or we hear a voice from the inside, from prisoners who become writers and poets. The most influential of our prison poets is probably Etheridge Knight, who was championed by none other than Gwendolyn Brooks.
Etheridge Knight is perceptive. His vision is merciless. He spares himself nothing. And he spares you nothing.
Brooks introduced Etheridge Knight at a reading at the Library of Congress in 1986, about 5 years before he died. We're going to hear a few of the poems he read on that occasion, and we're also going to hear from Tony Rehagen. Tony's a freelance writer who recently wrote a piece for our website about Etheridge Knight. It's called No Square Poet's Job. He joins me from his home outside of St. Louis. Hi, Tony.
How are you?
I'm good. A lot of people may have heard the name Etheridge Knight, but they don't necessarily know his story. Give us a little thumbnail about who he was and how he ended up in prison.
Well, he followed his father around for a couple places, but he ended up in Indianapolis. And there is kind of, he fell into street life, became addicted to opiates and drugs, allegedly through his military career, and just kind of was in and out of trouble as a youth. And that kind of followed him into adulthood, where he got pinched for armed robbery and ended up in Indiana State Prison.
So I think it's probably safe to say that he wouldn't have become a poet if he hadn't gone to prison. Is that reasonable?
You know, I asked several of his contemporaries and several people who've done the research, and they seem to think that the poet was there, but it wouldn't have manifested itself the same way. Kind of that, and this is something that he dealt with later in his career, that kind of lightning focus that comes from having nothing but time and confinement to kind of be alone with your thoughts and to focus that towards its art form. So it's a complicated question, but a lot of people say that the soul of the poet was there. As I had said, kind of when he was coming up, you know, he was out in the streets hanging around pool halls and so forth, and really kind of picked up kind of the oral tradition, the African-American tradition of toasting. And that really kind of followed him. So a lot of the people I talked to thought that he kind of already was a poet, but it really kind of manifested itself in kind of its formal form, as formal as he got anyway, while he was behind bars.
Mm-hmm. So following the publication of some of his poems in the magazine Negro Digest, I guess this was about 1965, 1966, he started getting a lot of attention from the African-American literary world, including Gwendolyn Brooks, as I mentioned. Tell us about how that, he just sort of exploded on the scene in the mid-60s. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, he did. I mean, and from all accounts that I found, he kind of solicited that. He wrote a little bit for prison publications, but then he started sending his work out. He kind of believed in it, and fortunately, Gwendolyn Brooks took him kind of under wing and really kind of fostered and really cultivated his raw talent. It was kind of the right thing at the right time, because so much was going on in the Black Arts Movement and the Civil Rights Movement. That perspective from being in jail and being able to articulate it so viscerally and so powerfully really just, I think, rang true. And it was just like, it was the right thing at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear a bit of what got them interested in Etheridge Knight. This poem is called Hard Rock Returns to Prison from the Hospital for the Criminally Insane.
Hard Rock was known not to take no shit from nobody, and he had the scars to prove it. Split purple lips, lumped ears, welts above his yellow eyes, and one long scar that cut across his temple and plowed through a thick canopy of kinky hair. The word was that Hard Rock wasn't a mean nigga anymore, that the doctors had bored a hole in his head, cut out part of his brain, and shot electricity through the rest. When they brought Hard Rock back, handcuffed and chained, he was turned loose like a freshly gelded stallion to try his new status. And we all waited and watched, like Indians at a corral, to see if the word was true. As we waited, we wrapped ourselves in the cloak of his exploits, Man, the last time it took 8 screws to put him in the hole. Yeah, remember when he smacked the captain with his dinner tray? He set the record for time in the hole, 67 straight days. Old Hard Rock, man, that's one crazy nigga. And then the jewel of a myth that Hard Rock had once bit a screw on the thumb and poisoned him with syphilitic spit. The testing came to see if Hard Rock was really tame. A hillbilly called him a black son of a bitch and didn't lose his teeth. A screw who knew Hard Rock from before shook him down and barked in his face. And Hard Rock did nothing, just grinned and looked silly, his eyes empty like knotholes in a fence. And even after we discovered that it took Hard Rock exactly 3 minutes to tell you his first name, we told ourselves that he had just wised up, was being cool, but we could not fool ourselves for long, and we turned away, our eyes on the ground, crushed. He had been our destroyer, the doer of things we dreamed of doing but could not bring ourselves to do. The fears of years, like a biting whip, had cut grooves too deeply across our backs.
So that was Etheridge Knight reading Hard Rock Returns to Prison from the Hospital for the Criminal Insane. And Tony, at the end of that poem, he says, the fears of years, like a biting whip, had cut deep bloody grooves across our backs. I think I know what he's referring there to, but I want to get your take on that ending.
I think it's a pretty clear allusion to slavery and the effects it's had, you know, even then, hundred years later, and the effects that it's still having. I think it's a pretty clear allusion to that, and the weight that it's at the basis of all of this, of mass incarceration, of the things he talked about, and just again in that typical Knight way of being able to provide it so viscerally and so brutally, making no buts about it that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, the prison strikers I mentioned at the top of the program are making the same claim that basically. Modern prisons are institutions of slavery, and many critics of mass incarceration are saying the same thing. Now, it's not clear what happened to Hard Rock, but a lobotomy is rumored. What do you make of what happened to Hard Rock?
Well, the bored a hole in his head pretty much points directly to a lobotomy, but I think it's that metaphorical lobotomy. It's this trying not only to sweep the undesirables under the rug by putting them in prison, but it's the idea of forced, and it's not rehabilitation in the positive sense that people would like to have you mean it, but it's like trying to homogenize them, or at least make them quote unquote safe for polite society.
Yeah, it's about control. Idea. It's about control.
Exactly.
Right. And in more recent times, lobotomies they don't do anymore. But in more recent times, I think solitary confinement has been deployed as a similar way to control prisoners with pretty devastating effects as well.
Absolutely, it's been deemed inhumane by a lot of states. There's also an interesting thing I noticed in the second stanza, and this is something that came up, where he talks about Indians, the second to last line of the second stanza.
And we all waited and watched, like Indians at a corral, to see if the word was true.
He later changed that line, because now the poem reads, and we all waited and watched like a herd of sheep. And that kind of points to this idea. He didn't see things black and white, even though he was lumped into the black arts movement. He was more of a, and some of his friends had said this, his contemporaries, that he was more of a class guy, that it was more about socioeconomic status. And that included inviting people of all ethnicities. And so the changing of that line shows kind of how he became sensitive to that. And so he got rid of the Indians and put in like a herd of sheep.
Interesting. That must have happened right at the end of his life before he died, yeah. Etheridge Knight had emotional and tonal range. And I don't know if you know this one, but I want to play a darkly comic poem for you called Rehabilitation and Treatment in the Prisons of America.
The convict strolled into the prison administration building to get assistance and counseling for his personal problems. Inside the main door were several other doors proclaiming doctor, lawyer, teacher, counselor, preacher, therapist. He chose the proper door and was confronted with two more doors, custody and treatment. He chose treatment, went in, and was confronted with two more doors, first offender, previous offender. Again, he chose the proper door, and again, two doors, Democrat and Republican. He was a Democrat, So he rushed through that door and ran smack into two more doors, black and white. He was black, so he rushed through that door and fell 9 stories to the street. That's cold.
Now, Tony, I don't know whether to laugh or cry at that ending. That is something else. Sure. It's got the dark humor of Kafka, but there's also something folksy or kind of fairy tale like about it. Is that typical of his work?
It is, and it's typical of his life story too. That was kind of the challenging thing of telling his life story, was that like one of his friends had told me that you're going to get the legend of Etheridge Knight, and he kind of fostered that. And it's all rooted in that oral history, the tradition of the toast, where you kind of embellish and you kind of just push things. You take things that are based in fact and you embellish it and exaggerate it, partially for entertainment, but also just kind of the practice of doing it, kind of creating that legend. So yeah, it's rooted in both his work and his actual life outside of it. And that's what makes it so complicated, because when you're trying to build a biography of somebody, you want to be able to rely on their work, but you cannot rely, especially with Etheridge Knight, you cannot rely on his work to be autobiographical. He's gonna bob and weave and try to get out from under you.
Yeah, you point this out in your piece. His story is really hard to pin down. Even the fact that he said that he served in Korea during the Korean War, but there's no real evidence that he did. There's no evidence that he didn't either, right?
Right, yeah. There was the fire that burned through his records, and there was records of his enlistment. He was definitely a veteran. He was definitely in the military. But as far as actual documented proof that he served in the Korean conflict, there's nothing there. And a biographer and then one of his friends told me that they had heard from pretty reputable sources that he'd never done that, and he kind of just ran with that story. Because it's in his author's note.
Yeah, he partly ran with it to explain his opium habit, right? Because he came out of the war traumatized and really took up heroin and other drugs.
Well, and it's also being able to go to kind of that tie to the Veterans Hospital, which is where he would be able to get some of the opiates and some of the medications, the morphine and things. So it's all kind of tied up in that, at least according to some of his contemporaries.
Mm-hmm. Now, Etheridge Knight has been very influential and very important to many poets. Can you talk about that a bit, his influence today and all the people that continue to cite him as important influences?
Absolutely. And the influence is really wide-ranging. Of course, he was an influence on Reginald Dwayne Betts and Randall Horton, both of whom had served time in jail and emerged and became very prominent and accomplished poets.
Yeah.
But also other poets like John Murillo, Christopher Gilbert, and Terence Hayes, who, of course, is a major figure now, just is putting out a book to float in the space between, which is built completely around one of his marquee poems, kind of the foundation of Poems from Prison, his first book, which is the Idea of Ancestry.
And yep, we're going to hear that. We're going to hear that in a minute. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the entire book of To Float in the Space Between is basically taking that poem, Idea of Ancestry, line by line, and sketching essays to each line. Some of them are biographical about Etheridge Knight, although Hayes, and I talked to him for the story, had mentioned the same thing I did. Like, you know, you set out to write a book about Etheridge Knight, you're not going to, the biography is impossible.
Right.
Because there's so many different, it's just a maze of facts and myth that you have to kind of siphon out. So he wrote this, and I got a great chance to read the advanced copy, this great book, which just kind of takes every line of Idea of Ancestry and sketches it out. Terence Hayes has cited both in his work directly that he was influenced by Knight and his realness and the rhythm of his poetry as well.
Mm-hmm. So let's go out on that poem, actually. It's fairly long, and it may be his greatest poem. It's certainly his most famous. And even though it's on the long side for this podcast, it really does work as an audio poem. As you said, it's called The Idea of Ancestry. It starts in his prison cell where he has decorated his wall with family pictures.
I started making up this poem when I was in solitary one time. After being called by a number for 5 years, 30,562, I was beginning to forget who I was. The idea of ancestry. Taped to the wall of my cell are 47 pictures, 47 black faces. My father, mother, grandmothers, one dead, grandfathers, both dead, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, cousins, first and second, nieces and nephews. They stare across the space at me, sprawling on my bunk. I know their dark eyes, they know mine. I know their style, they know mine. I am all of them, they are all of me. They are farmers, I am a thief. I am me, they are thee. I have at one time or another been in love with my mother, one grandmother, two sisters, two aunts, one went to the asylum, and five cousins. I am now in love with a seven-year-old niece. She sends me letters written in large block print, and her picture is the only one that smiles at me. I have the same name as one grandfather, three cousins, three nephews, and one uncle. The uncle disappeared when he was 15, just took off and caught a freight, they say. He's discussed each year when the family has a reunion. He causes uneasiness in the clan. He is an empty space. My father's mother, who is 93 and who keeps the family Bible with everybody's birth dates and death dates in it, always mentions him. There's no place in her Bible for whereabouts unknown. Each fall, the graves of my grandfathers call me. The brown hills and red gullies of Mississippi send out their electric messages, galvanizing my genes. Last year, like a salmon quitting the cold ocean, leaping and bucking up his birth stream, I hitchhiked my way from L.A. with 16 caps in my pocket and a monkey on my back. And I almost kicked it with the kinfolk. I walked barefooted in my grandmother's backyard. I smelled the old land and the woods. I sipped corn whiskey from fruit jars with the men. I flirted with the women. I had a ball till the caps ran out and my habit came down. That night, I looked at my grandmother and split. My guts were screaming for junk, but I was almost contented. I had almost caught up with me. The next day in Memphis, I cracked a croaker's crib for a fix. This year, there is a gray stone wall damming my stream, and when the falling leaves stir my jeans, I pace my cell, a flop on my bunk, and stare at 47 black faces across the space. I am all of them, they are all of me. I am me, they are thee, and I have no sons to float in the space between.
That was Etheridge Knight reading The Idea of Ancestry. Tony, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Tony Rehagen wrote a piece for us about Etheridge Knight called No Square Poet's Job. You can read it and some poems by Knight on our website. Send us your comments and suggestions. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.